Accession number 8234, rule number 1.
Colonel Draffen, reel 1. I understand that you'd done some military training in OTCs before you went out to Kenya in 1933.
Yes, I really started at school where I took the Certificate A, and then at university I took the Certificate B. And when I arrived in Kenya, I, as everybody had to, joined the Kenya Defence Force. Every single European was in the Kenya Defence Force, and I was merely one of the many privates. Until I decided that I felt that war was not far away, and in 1937 I applied for a commission in the King's African Rifles Reserve of Officers, which I was fortunate enough to obtain.
What sort of training had you done in the Kenya Defence Force?
Kenya Defence Force was weekend training, and occasionally I think I attended one week camp, but very little training really. It was merely to record numbers and names.
Were the basic principles of tactics and administration you were taught in the Kenya Defence Force different to those you had learned in the OTCs?
No. I think that basically they were based on the same fundamental principles. They were just ordinary, as applied through the brigade staff in Nairobi.
When you applied for your commission, did you have to go through a selection process?
Yes. I went up to brigade headquarters in Nairobi and was interviewed by Brigadier Campbell, I think his name. But that was all.
No practical tests then?
No practical tests. They said that my Certificate B, which was the university one, was satisfactory.
Did you have to do a training course to become an officer?
No, they commissioned me straight away, but we did a month's training every year with one of the Kenya battalions. And I was very fortunate in that I only did my training with the 5th Battalion.
And that was the battalion you eventually joined?
And that I was called up to the 5th at the outbreak of war and remained with them until I was demobilised at the end of the war.
Now, you mentioned that you thought a war was coming in 1937. Why did you think a war was likely?
I can't really give you an answer at this stage. It's so long ago. I felt that the whole world was beginning to turn over at that time, and I presume I used to get a monthly paper from home, and I can only presume that it was the build-up of the German forces under Nazi regime that put the idea into my head, though I had no idea that we would be implicated down in Africa.
Can you remember if there was any particular moment when you felt that a war was unavoidable?
No, not until it was completely imminent. I mean, the last two or three months when you were just hanging on. No, I had no premonitions on that one at all.
You say you hadn't thought that East Africa would be involved. This would seem to suggest that you had not considered Italy to be a potential enemy.
No, I rather looked upon the Italians as being rather pacifist, and that they wouldn't trouble. I hadn't, of course, taken into account the Northern Italian, who is a very strong-willed, aggressive gentleman, as opposed to the sun-loving, banjo-strumming chaps from the south.
Had you met many Italians?
Yes, one or two in quite a few in Kenya. They owned farms and were farm managers. And not many, but there were. They are Italian.
So you met enough to form an opinion of them?
No, I didn't. They were just very nice people. Generally speaking, I should say on the lazy side.
Had you formed any ideas at all as to what strategy or tactics our enemies might employ?
Well, only from my training, my month's training each year, which were based on the principles, actually, that were evolved when I was at Reading, at university. They were just the same.
I think you were called up on the 27th of August 1939.
Yes.
How was that done? What happened?
Well, all reserve officers, and there were only 16 actual KAR reserve officers, were called up to their respective battalions on that date. And it was during the week prior to the actual declaration of war by Italy that the main recruitment started. In the old days, I say, everybody was in the Kenya Defence Force, but shortly after I arrived in Kenya, they formed the Kenya Regiment, which was a very strong and very good unit. And most Europeans joined the Kenya Regiment. And at the outbreak of war, we had a large draft of officers and NCOs, British officers and NCOs, sent straight from the Kenya Regiment. The consequence was, of course, that we had to organise cadre courses in the battalion so as to find out how much they knew and what sort of chaps they were.
How much did they know?
I think their basic training was very sound. They obviously didn't know anything about mortars because we had only been issued. In fact, we weren't issued with mortars until the outbreak of war when we got one for our cadre course. But no, their basic training was very sound.
So they'd had a basic infantry training?
Did they?
They'd had a basic infantry training.
Yes, a very good basic infantry training. And I think you must remember that 99% of the Europeans in Kenya had been on safari and were interested in watching game, and their approach to cover and moving across ground was rather exceptional.
So fieldcraft was a natural.
Fieldcraft became a natural attribute.
Apart from running cadre courses to assess and improve this influx of people, what else did the 5th Battalion have to do?
Well, the first part of the war was started, as I say, with this training. But we also did, which we were extremely keen on, a tremendous amount of barrack square bashing. We found it was most important from both the European and the African point of view. In fact, I believe that the discipline is basically instilled from the barrack square. And it's something that fortunately the Askari really appreciated. And during the whole of the war, when we came out of action, and we were having a rest period, even though we were training, we'll say, to go into the jungle again, we put the chaps on the barrack square and started back at square one to give them this basic discipline training.
Why do you think that they enjoyed it?
They love being smart. They're great actors. They loved showing off. And it suited their natures.
So it was a sort of pride in ceremonial display.
Absolutely.
To them.
Yes. In fact, pride was a great asset to the Askari. He loved his battalion, he loved his country, and he was willing to give of his best, provided he was properly led.
Did you have to remedy any deficiencies in equipment to put the battalion on a war footing?
Well, virtually we had very little equipment. We weren't up to establishment in anything at the very outset of the war, except in rifles. Machine guns were very short supply. As I say, mortars were issued, and we got one at the beginning of the war so as to put it in our card, of course, and we went on from there. Fortunately, the Italians gave us plenty of time to get our establishment up to war strength.
I'd like to talk a bit more about the battalion. Was the battalion brought up to strength in men and officers and NCOs?
The battalion was, at the outbreak of war, up to war establishment in African ranks, but not in European ranks. And that is why we had the big influx of officers and NCOs from the Kenya Regiment. But being a regular battalion at full strength at the outset of the war, we were called upon to give away most tremendous number of chaps to go and reform the new battalions. And this was a continual drain. So we were in the state of getting probably up to a third of our strength would go, and we received a third of our strength in recruits who we had to train to our way of thinking again.
Did this cause us a serious disruption?
Yes. It was a very serious problem because we, like every other battalion, were determined to hang on to our good men. On the other hand, we had to give people away so as to make our contribution to the major war effort. And it was a conflict amongst ourselves, really.
A moral dilemma.
A moral dilemma, absolutely.
Who actually selected the men who are to be thrown off to form new battalions?
Well, we did it by asking company commanders to make their recommendations, and this went to the commanding officer, who, with the second in command, and on occasions he would call in the company commanders to verify decisions, but it came from the bottom upwards.
Did you have any difficulty absorbing members of the draft that came in?
No, because even in that time, the battalion commander was very keen on establishing a battalion with certain percentages of the good fighting tribes. And we laid down, actually, I don't remember all the figures, but for instance, we said we would like 35% of Wakamba and 35% of Luo. We did not want any Kikuyu. We would take as many Somalis as we could absorb, and we would like up to 25% of the Kalenjin tribes, the Kipsigis and allied tribes. But there again, they really should have been classified as the Somalis. We would take as many as we could get, because there weren't all that number.
Did you manage to achieve this balance of tribal?
Yes, the COs were absolutely adamant. And for the whole of the time I was with the battalion, if we received a draft of recruits and there were more of one tribe than the other, we sent them back and were willing to go under establishment until the recruiting sections could put us where we wanted to be.
Was there ever any friction between the tribes within the battalion?
No, provided you kept them separate. We wouldn't even have tribal sections, never mind tribal platoons, as some battalions did. We felt that the right thing was to have a complete mixture right down to the section, so that you avoided tribal difficulties and built up platoon and section, of course, company and battalion esprit de corps.
How could you do that? Did you do it by competitions or by other means?
No, it was just the company commander said, well, I've got this many, so many men from each tribe, and I must divide them in this way or the other.
What I meant was, how did you build up the esprit de corps of the platoons and companies?
Oh, entirely through playing games against each other and drill competitions. And any, as much outside activities, sports, we used to organise tremendous sports meetings. In fact, the Kipsigis were particularly good at sport, and they'd usually won the brigade sports. And we built up our esprit de corps and our real platoon section even, as well as battalion feelings on those lines.
What sort of sports did they like particularly?
They loved their running, and they loved this wonderful game called Karamoja, which was as many men as you could get either side of a football field. It didn't matter whether you started with 15 or you had 115, and you played with a soccer ball, but you could handle it as in rugger, you could tackle as in rugger, you could hand off, you could kick forward, you could do what you like as long as you got the ball through the net.
Sounds like a game of mess rugby.
Yes, it's mess.
Apart from sports, what other sort of recreations did the troops enjoy?
Very little, because in the early part, we were completely stationed at Nanyuki with detachments up in the NFD of two companies, and they got no leave except after the first year, and they virtually had to have their own organisations within the battalion. The only African evening entertainment was that we used to allow them ngomas or dances when they had brewed their own beer and presumably no Nubian gin, but I think it crept in every now and then.
You mentioned tribal affiliations. What about religious affiliations? Were they important?
They weren't important from any point of view other than the food. I don't think we had any difficulties ever on religious grounds, except that the Mohammedans, of course, wanted their meat killed in a certain way, and the animal had to face east or west or whatever it was, and have its throat cut in a particular method. In fact, we had special tinned meat provided for the Somalis, for the Mohammedans, where the rabbi had been present to see that it was properly killed and it was all written on the label. This worked very well, and they rather insisted on their special food until we got to Burma. But then, of course, when we went into the campaign, we were being supplied by road. But the monsoon broke a fortnight early, and the Air Force had not been organised to start the dropping zones, and we got pretty hungry because the food was cut off by these terrific floods. And we found that the the Somali or the Mohammedan would eat anything. It didn't matter.
What about the question of drink? Did they drink the beer?
Yes, they would drink local beer. But you see, it's always all a question of knowing. I remember in Well, in the Burma campaign, seeing we were stationed at a place called Chas, where there were a certain number of Asian shops, and we were having a rest period. And I saw a Somali corporal coming home from the shops with a pair of candles connected by the thread, the string, swinging these on his hand. Well, I happened to know that they were pig fat. And he'd known that, he wouldn't have touched them, never mind bought them. But it's mostly a question of knowledge.
Presumably they also had to have separate cooking arrangements.
No, because they merely were given their meat in the tin so that they could see that it was all right. And they accepted this. The company cooks pushed their stuff aside and kept it separate. It was quite good.
What other religions were they represented?
Well, they were mostly the Mohammedans, of course, from the coastal section. The upcountry chaps were either agnostics, there were a few Catholics and a few Christians, Protestants. But throughout the war, we never saw any Mohammedan rabbis or priests, whereas we did have in each brigade had a Catholic priest and a Church of England priest.
Did the Muslims say their prayers?
Yes. Not as avidly as one gets the impression on the television that they bow down, but they did. I think they were more circumspect about it. They did it quietly behind their tents. They didn't make a show of it.
And what about the Christians? Did you have regular services for them?
Not for the Africans so much, though I think it would be interesting to make the comment that at the end of the war, when we were in Burma and VJ Day came, we had in our battalion, he'd lived with the battalion for both the Madagascan campaign and the Burma campaign, a Father Harry Van Eerden, who was an ardent Catholic from South Africa, and a most tremendous chap. And we were 25 miles away from brigade with no transport. And we got the news in the morning at about 8 o'clock. And Father Harry came into the mess and said, I've been summoned to brigade and I shall be away taking services. Have they arranged any service for you? And I said, no. They said, if we could get there, we'd be welcome, but we couldn't march 25 miles to a service and 25 miles back again. So I saw no prospect of a service. He said, well, look, if you like to arrange for your service and give me a little pro forma when I come back, I will hold a quick service for your battalion. Fortunately, we had a prayer book somewhere, and we summoned up a few hymns that we could think of and put down the order of the service, and Father Harry did it absolutely magnificently. He said exactly the right things.
What was the general state then of morale and discipline in the battalion?
I think that the morale of the battalion was simply tremendous, and it always was. At the very beginning of the war, of course, there was no flogging. That had gone out 6 or 8 years before the war started. And I always remember our commanding officer, when we left Kenya and went over the border, telling the battalion that now they were going into battle and outside Kenya. I don't think he was correct in this, but he said, because we're outside Kenya, we're not under Kenya's jurisdiction, therefore I will reimpose the flogging ordinance. So if anybody does anything for which flogging is a punishment, he will be flogged. And this happened once. We'd just gone over the border and we had a case. The battalion was formed up in Hollow Square and the culprit was marched in and he saluted the flag. He took off his hat. He was told to lie down. His offence was read out and he was given 6 with a kiboko, which is a rhino hide whip. He then leapt to his feet, put on his hat, saluted the flag and was marched off. And we never had another case of any ill discipline which necessitated beating.
What had this chap done to?
Do you know, I forget now. I think he'd gone off to some village and raped some women, or it was something of that sort.
And what was the effect upon him? I mean, did it have a salutary effect on him?
Oh, he had no chip on his shoulder. He knew. And I think this is the greatest thing about the African. If you impose certain disciplinary actions or disciplinary a code of discipline and you tell him about it and he accepts it, then he bears no malice. He knew that he'd done wrong, and that was that.
What sort of offences were prevalent or normal within the battalion?
Oh, I think only occasional excessive drinking, which caused fights, and women. The only two, really, things that caused any difficulties.
And apart from flogging, which you say was rare, what other sort of penalties were imposed?
Oh, just the normal military, confined to barracks, and extra drill, and the normal disciplinary things that come along with the army.
But presumably once they were in the field, there were less opportunities for offences.
Oh, yes. But you've got very little difficulty in the field.
How was the battalion organised?
From what point of view?
What was its structure?
Oh, 4 rifle companies and a headquarter company. Headquarter company looked after